since this is this time of year where we all get really stressed about finishing our undergraduate degree, mm-hmm. and looking for jobs, what is the career of an academic? What is it?
Would I recommend it? Or what?
Well, what does it involve?
Well, the first thing nowadays you'd have to do is get a PhD. It's much more regimented than it used to be. You know, I don't have a PhD, but it's impossible now to get in by any other route, usually. So you look at another 3 or 4 years before you can even start looking for an academic job. And such is the competition now that you would probably find you spent 2 or 3 years maybe doing 6 months temporary job while somebody was on leave, or that kind of thing, or a research assistant kind of job. And at that, the same time, you'd be trying to build up your teaching experience, because, well, in this department, you'd probably get some level 1, 2 tutorials to do, and you'd be trying to publish, so that you would go into your first interview for a real job with probably more qualifications than people had 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's tougher. I mean, there's obviously more universities, but then there's always more graduates. So.
How has academic life changed since you started with your full-time?
Well, I came in, I think, and just when it was beginning to change, I became a lecturer in 1979. And as we moved into the 80s, you began to get a lot more government attempts to control what people were doing. I mean, when I first came here, university departments were very leisurely places. I'm sure people were working hard, but there was no sense of activity, really. There were enough staff for the students, which probably isn't true nowadays. Far fewer students. And then people began to question what universities were doing with the money that was being put into them. So you got the beginning of a thing called the research assessment exercise, which has really governed people's lives, because everybody's research is assessed and you get a grade, and a lot of other things depend on what your grade is, you know, how much money you get and so on.
That and must there put were, a lot of pressure on onto research.
It does, yeah, and it's, I mean, I think that's one of the biggest changes, it's short-term pressure.
Yeah.
You know, before you could have a life work, and nobody would question that you would maybe produce the one great book when you were 50. But now, if you don't have 4 things to put into the research assessment in the next 5 years, then you're in trouble. And if you're not selected, you're in even worse trouble, because that is regarded as the baseline. And of course, if you've got a competition like that, academics are quite clever, so they learn how to manipulate it. So every year, you know, every time it gets worse, or they have to think of new ways of distinguishing between people, because it's grade inflation. It's like, you know, hires and A-levels, that you've got far more people getting the top grade. So instead of the top grade being 5, it's 5-star, you know, that sort of thing. And at the same time, they began to look much more closely at teaching and how people taught, and especially how they recorded stuff. I think that's the single biggest difference, is the amount of paper. And I think a lot of people would say that about their jobs. Some of that's been good, because I think students have benefited, because they have a more idea of what's going on, and I think they have more idea of their entitlements. But it has meant an awful lot of form filling, and doing things just because you're told to do them. I mean, there was no such thing when I started as a course handbook, say. The idea that you would want to know what you were going to do every week would never have occurred to anyone. You just came and you did what you were told. An essay handout, you know, there used to be one handwritten list of essay titles that was pinned on a notice board, and you stood and copied it down. And of course, the electronic revolution has made a big difference. That's probably saved us from drowning in paper, because we can now email a lot of this stuff, or put it on Moodle or whatever. So the whole thing is much more tightly controlled, I think. And of course the classes are bigger. I mean, you don't have an honours tutorial with four people in it now. So
for some subjects you do.
Well, maybe you do. Yeah. So, well, the first year is probably the one that's grown the most. Because that's maybe quadrupled in the time I've been here. So there are quite a lot of changes. Not all bad, but...
Did you enjoy your career?
Yes, yeah. I mean, mine was quite mixed because I didn't really intend to become an academic. I mean, I'd spent a few years before that in America and teaching English in a foreign language, which is the great fallback position for people with degrees like you will have. And really I took the thesaurus job because I was interested in dictionaries, but not really thinking of it as a route to an academic job. So I really became an academic because that was the only way of getting a permanent job that would enable me to carry on with the thesaurus.
But you do not regret this decision?
No, no. Mm-hmm. It's been interesting, yeah. And I've learned a lot.
Over the years, how has English language grown as a subject?
I think in this department, and probably many others, although there aren't many others, by taking in a lot from modern linguistics. I mean, when I started, the core of the whole operation was historical. You know, everybody did a lot more Old English than, I don't know what you've chosen to do.
But no, I think those are the smallest classes now.
Yeah, I mean, that was the syllabus. Believe it or not, everybody in English literature had to do an honours paper in Old English, which caused quite a lot of unpopularity. And you had to learn it a lot more thoroughly. You know, you were expected to parse things and comment on them. So I think the big change is having subjects like phonetics and grammar and semantics and so on. Partly that's because linguistics has grown. I mean, there was hardly a discipline called sociolinguistics, say, in the 1970s. It's a very new. And the ones that have grown out of grammar, like discourse analysis, nobody would have thought of teaching pragmatics, you know, 40 years ago. So there's more subject content, and it probably appeals to a wider range of people. So that's probably the main thing. But Glasgow is slightly unusual because we don't have a linguistics department. So we're covering stuff that elsewhere would be part of linguistics, which gives us, well, it gives our students quite an unusual range, in fact.
How has this this range of choices influence employability?
Well, it makes you very versatile. I mean, I still think there's truth in the adage that if you've got a good degree and you've got a critical mind and you know how to deal with information, then you're fit to do quite a lot of general jobs.
Transferable skills.
Yeah, transferable skills are very important. And nowadays, of course, they include computing. The ability to write is quite an important transferable skill. If you see some of the really bad writing, I've had to look recently at reports from estate agents, and, you know, I just want to sit and correct the grammar. So there are skills like that, the communication skills, I think, and that's something I think that's improved, that you do more speaking nowadays. We wouldn't have thought of speaking as being a useful skill, you know, in past days. There's no particular career path. I mean, I've mentioned EFL teaching, but any kind of writing job, I mean, there aren't the opportunities in print journalism that they used to be, but there are all sorts of other opportunities that involve writing or some kind of research, where you have to go to libraries and dig stuff out. I mean, you can't get everything off the internet even now. So I think you're quite employable.
Good.
It's good to know you.
I mean, I don't know if, you know, there are a few jobs in dictionaries, there are a few jobs in publishing. There aren't a lot of jobs in anything, but...
Many students.
Yeah. But, I mean, partly it just depends in being able to present a range of skills, I think, not just I can do one thing and that's what I want to do.
So, what would you suggest to undergrads starting, say, next year, how to make themselves more employable?
Well, I think employers still attach a lot of importance to being involved in things outside your actual degree. I mean, obviously, one of the main things is getting decent marks. So, especially in the first year, the temptation is just to mess about for a bit. The Scottish system is fairly well adapted to that, in that you can make up. But even so, it's better not to have to do that. But all the traditional things, I think, like student journalism, still count for something, or doing some kind of voluntary work, or just generally showing that you've got a bit of initiative. You know, running something's always a good thing, even a small thing like maybe not for undergrads, but postgrads quite often run little conferences, for instance, or put together newsletters, that kind of thing. But I think nowadays probably the majority of students will have to do some kind of paid work. I mean, that's another huge change. It would have been unheard of, I think, for my generation or the one after to feel that you had to work in order to make your way through university. And that's just got worse and worse.
Now it's the norm.
Yeah. And we've got to adapt to that. And the plus side of that, I suppose, is that you do get some work experience, even if it's not strictly relevant, but even the fact that you've turned up at the cafe and done this dreadful job for so many hours a week for 4 years, it shows a certain stamina and reliability, and you've got someone that will write your reference, and you've also got every incentive not to get stuck there. So, yeah.
How do you think the funding cuts, especially in England, will influence English language as a subject?
Well, there's always a risk with minority subjects, and what's happened in England is what's happening here at the moment, in that English language was absorbed into schools of English or into even bigger schools like we now have here, and there's always a risk of a small unit being absorbed by a big one, because then your priorities change. So if you're in a school of English and you've got 100 students doing American literature, and you've got 10 doing medieval literature, and you've got one job, what do you go for? You know, there may be good academic reasons for continuing to teach medieval literature, and not just saying, okay, we'll start with Shakespeare, but you've got the pressure of numbers always. So I think it could have a bad effect, in that it might squeeze out things at the edges, or squeeze out detail, for instance. Because I think quite a lot of places now, they will only have maybe one module on the structure of English, say, one semester, and they'll have one semester on the history of the English language. And then they'll have a few options that people that are interested in can go on to, but probably not the range that you've got here, or not in the depth. So I think there are risks that the bigger the units get, the smaller the number of subjects in some ways, and the less coherent. I mean, that's another change, that in the early days you didn't really have any choice, or not much choice. You know, if you did English, you did 2 first years language and literature, 2 second years, 8 honours papers, of which Shakespeare and Old English were compulsory for everybody. Beyond that, you had a certain amount of choice on authors in English Lit or periods in English language. Now you've got a much broader choice.
I think that's pretty good, yeah.
Is that okay?
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Thank you.